Chapter 46. Club Snobs, why did I, and Wagley ever do so cruel an action, as to introduce young Sackville Maine into that odious sarcophagus? Let our imprudence and his example be a warning to other gents. Let his fate and that of his poor wife be remembered by every British female. The consequences of his entering the club were as follows. One of the first vices the unhappy wretch acquired in this abode of frivolity was that of smoking. Some of the dandies of the club, such as the Marquis of Macabaw, Lord Dudine, and fellows of that high order, are in the habit of indulging in this propensity upstairs in the billiard rooms of the sarcophagus, and, partly to make their acquaintance, partly from a natural aptitude for crime, Sackville Maine followed them, and became an adept in the odious custom. Where it is introduced into a family, I need not say how sad the consequences are, both to the furniture and the morals. Sackville smoked in his dining room at home, and caused an agony to his wife and mother-in-law which I do not venture to describe. He then became a professed billiard player, wasting hours upon hours at that amusement, betting freely, playing tolerably, losing awfully to Captain Spot and Colonel Cannon. He played matches of 100 games with these gentlemen, and would not only continue until 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning at this work, but would be found at the club of a forenoon, indulging himself to the detriment of his business, the ruin of his health, and the neglect of his wife. Greater than from billiards to whist, is but a step, and when a man gets to whist, and £5 on a rubber, my opinion is, that it is all up with him. How was the coal business to go on, and the connection of the firm to be kept up, and the senior partner always at the card table? Consorting now with genteel persons and Pall Mall bucks, Sackville became ashamed of his snug little residence in Kennington Oval, and transported his family to Pimlico, where, though Mrs. Chuff, his mother-in-law, was at first happy, as the quarter was elegant, and near her sovereign, poor little Laura and the children found a woeful difference. Where were her friends who came in with their work of a morning? At Kennington and in the vicinity of Clapham. Where were her children's little playmates? On Kennington Common. The great thundering carriages that roared up and down the drab-colored streets of the new quarter contained no friends for the sociable little Laura. The children that paced the squares, attended by a bonne or a prim governess, were not like those happy ones that flew kites, or played hopscotch, on the well-beloved old common. And what a difference a church to! Between St. Benedict's of Pimlico, with open seats, service in sing-song tapers, alps, surplices, garlands and processions, and the honest old ways of Kennington. The footmen who, attending St. Benedict's, were so splendid and enormous, that James, Mrs. Chuff's boy, trembled amongst them, and said he would give warning, rather than carry the books to that church any more. The furnishing of the house was not done without expense. And, ye gods, what a difference there was between Sackville's dreary French banquets in Pimlico, and the jolly dinners at the Oval. No more legs of mutton, no more of the best port wine in England, apostrophe but entrees on plate, and dismal twopenny champagne, and waiters in gloves, and the club bucks for company among whom Mrs. Chuff was uneasy, and Mrs. Sackville quite silent. Not that he dined at home often. The wretch had become a perfect epicure, and dined commonly at the club with the gormandizing clique there, with old Dr. Ma, Colonel Cramley, who is as lean as a greyhound, and has jaws like a jack, and the rest of them. Here you might see the wretch tippling Sillery champagne and gorging himself with French viands, and I often looked with sorrow from my table, on which cold meat, the club small beer, and a half pint of Marsala form the modest banquet, and sighed to think it was my work. And there were other beings present to my repentant thoughts. Where's his wife, thought I? Where's poor, good, kind little Laura? At this very moment it's about the nursery bedtime, and while yonder good-for-nothing is swilling his wine, the little ones are at Laura's knees lisping their prayers. And she is teaching them to say, "Pray God bless Papa." apostrophe apostrophe, when as he has put them to bed, her day's occupation is gone, and she is utterly lonely all night, and sad, and waiting for him. Oh, for shame! Oh, for shame! Go home, thou idle tippler! How Sackville lost his health colon, how he lost his business, how he got into scrapes, how he got into debt, how he became a railroad director, how the Pimlico house was shut up, how he went to Bowlin, all this I could tell, only I am too much ashamed of my part of the transaction. They returned to England, because, to the surprise of everybody, Mrs. Chuff came down with a great sum of money which nobody knew as he had saved, and paid his liabilities. He is in England, but at Kennington. His name was taken off the books of the sarcophagus long ago. When we meet, he crosses over to the other side of the street. I don't call, as I should be sorry to see a look of reproach or sadness in Laura's sweet face. Not, however, all evil, as I am proud to think, has been the influence of the snob of England upon clubs in general. Captain Shindy is afraid to bully the waiters any more, and eats his mutton chop without moving Acheron. Gobimich does not take more than 2 papers at a time for his private reading. Tix does not ring the bell and cause the library waiter to walk about a quarter of a mile in order to give him vol. 2, which lies on the next table. Growler has ceased to walk from table to table in the coffee room and inspect what people are having for dinner. Trotty Veck takes his own umbrella from the hall, the cotton one, and Sidney Scraper's palette lined with silk has been brought back by Jobbins, who entirely mistook it for his own. Wiggle has discontinued telling stories about the ladies he has killed. Snooks does not anymore think it gentlemanlike to blackball attorneys. Snuffler no longer publicly spreads out his great red cotton pocket handkerchief before the fire, for the admiration of 200 gentlemen. And if one club snob has been brought back to the paths of rectitude, and if one poor John has been spared a journey or a scolding, say, friends and brethren, if these sketches of club snobs have been in vain. Concluding observations on snobs, how it is that we have come to number 45 of this present series of papers, my dear friends and brother snobs, I hardly know, but for a whole mortal year have we been together, prattling, and abusing the human race, and were we to live for 100 years more, I believe there is plenty of subject for conversation in the enormous theme of snobs. The national mind is awakened to the subject. Letters pour in every day, conveying marks of sympathy, directing the attention of the snob of England to races of snobs yet undescribed. Where are your theatrical snobs, your commercial snobs, your medical and chirurgical snobs, your official snobs, your legal snobs, your artistical snobs, your musical snobs, your sporting snobs? Apostrophe, apostrophe, write my esteemed correspondents. Surely you are not going to miss the Cambridge Chancellor election, and omit showing up your Don Snobs, who are coming, cap in hand, to a young prince of 26, and to implore him to be the chief of their renowned university? Apostrophe, apostrophe, writes a friend who seals with the signet of the Cam and Isis Club. Pray, pray, apostrophe, cries another, now the operas are opening, give us a lecture about omnibus snobs. Apostrophe, apostrophe, indeed, I should like to write a chapter about the snobbish dons very much, and another about the snobbish dandies. Of my dear theatrical snobs I think with a pang, and I can hardly break away from some snobbish artists, with whom I have long, long intended to have a palaver. But what's the use of delaying? When these were done there would be fresh snobs to portray. The labor is endless. No single man could complete it. Here are but 52 bricks and a pyramid to build. It is best to stop. As Jones always quits the room, as soon as he has said his good thing, as Cincinnatus and General Washington both retired into private life in the height of their popularity, as Prince Albert, when he laid the first stone of the exchange, left the bricklayers to complete that edifice, and went home to his royal dinner, as the poet Bun comes forward at the end of the season, and with feelings too tumultuous to describe, blesses his kin friends over the footlights. So, friends, in the flush of conquest and the splendor of victory, amid the shouts and the plaudits of a people triumphant yet modest, the snob of England bids ye farewell. But only for a season. Not forever. No, no. There is one celebrated author whom I admire very much who has been taking leave of the public any time these 10 years in his prefaces, and always comes back again, when everybody is glad to see him. How can he have the heart to be saying goodbye so often? I believe that Bun is affected when he blesses the people. Parting is always painful. Even the familiar bore is dear to you. I should be sorry to shake hands even with Jawkins for the last time. I think a well-constituted convict, on coming home from transportation, ought to be rather sad when he takes leave of Van Diemen's Land. When the curtain goes down on the last night of a pantomime, poor old clown must be very dismal, depend on it. Ha! With what joy he rushes forward on the evening of the 26th of December next, and says, "How are you? Here we are." Apostrophe, but I am growing too sentimental. To return to the theme. The national mind is awakened to the subject of snobs. The word snob has taken a place in our honest English vocabulary. We can't define it, perhaps. We can't say what it is, any more than we can define wit, or humor, or humbug. But we know what it is. Some weeks since, happening to have the felicity to sit next to a young lady at a hospitable table, where poor old Jawkins was holding forth in a very absurd pompous manner, I wrote upon the spotless damask SB, apostrophe and called my neighbor's attention to the little remark. That young lady smiled. She knew it at once. Her mind straightway filled up the two letters concealed by apostrophic reserve, and I read in her assenting eyes that she knew Jawkins was a snob. You seldom get them to make use of the word as yet, it is true, but it is inconceivable how pretty an expression their little smiling mouths assume when they speak it out. If any young lady doubts, just let her go up to her own room, look at herself steadily in the glass, and say snob. Apostrophe, apostrophe, if she tries this simple experiment, my life for it, she will smile, and own that the word becomes her mouth amazingly. A pretty little round word, all composed of soft letters, with a hiss at the beginning, just to make it piquant, as it were. Jawkins, meanwhile, went on blundering, and bragging and boring, quite unconsciously. And so he will, no doubt, go on roaring and braying, to the end of time, or at least so long as people will hear him. You cannot alter the nature of men and snobs by any force of satire, as, by laying ever so many stripes on a donkey's back, you can't turn him into a zebra. But we can warn the neighborhood that the person whom they and Jawkins admire is an impostor. We apply the snob test to him, and try whether he is conceited and a quack, whether pompous and lacking humility, whether uncharitable and proud of his narrow soul. How does he treat a great man, how regard a small one? How does he comport himself in the presence of His Grace the Duke, and how in that of Smith the tradesman? And it seems to me that all English society is cursed by this mammoniacal superstition. And that we are sneaking and bowing and cringing on the one hand, or bullying and scorning on the other, from the lowest to the highest. My wife speaks with great circumspection, proper pride, apostrophe she calls it to our neighbor the tradesman's lady. And she, I mean Mrs. Snob, Eliza would give one of her eyes to go to court, as her cousin, the captain's wife, did. She, again, is a good soul, but it costs her agonies to be obliged to confess that we live in Upper Thompson Street, Somers Town. And though I believe in her heart Mrs. Whiskerington is fonder of us than of her cousins, the Smigsmags, you should hear how she goes on prattling about Lady Smigsmag. And I said to Sir John, my dear John, apostrophe and about the Smigsmags house, and parties in Hyde Park Terrace. Lady Smigsmag, when she meets Eliza, who is a sort of a kind of a species of a connection of the family, pokes out one finger, which my wife is at liberty to embrace in the most cordial manner she can devise. But oh, you should see her ladyship's behavior on her first shop dinner party days, when Lord and Lady Longears come. I can bear it no longer, this diabolical invention of gentility which kills natural kindliness and honest friendship. Proper pride, indeed. Rank and precedence, forsooth. The table of ranks and degrees is a lie, and should be flung into the fire. Organize rank and precedence. That was well for the masters of ceremonies of former ages. Come forward, some great marshal, and organize equality in society, and Erod shall swallow up all the juggling old court gold sticks. If this is not gospel truth, if the world does not tend to this, if hereditary great man worship is not a humbug, and an idolatry, let us have the Stuarts back again, and crop the free press's ears in the pillory. If ever our cousins, the Smigsmags, ask me to meet Lord Longears, I would like to take an opportunity after dinner and say, in the most good-natured way in the world, sir, fortune makes you a present of a number of £1,000 every year. The ineffable wisdom of our ancestors has placed you as a chief and hereditary legislator over me. Our admirable constitution, the pride of Britons and envy of surrounding nations, obliges me to receive you as my senator, superior, and guardian. Your eldest son, Fitzhugh, is sure of a place in Parliament. Your younger sons, the Debrays, will kindly condescend to be post-captains and lieutenants-colonels, and to represent us in foreign courts, or to take a good Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.